Hello and welcome to Zookeeping 101. This is the Zookeeper podcast where we take you behind the scenes talking to professionals in the industry about their stories, words of wisdom and journey so far to get to where they are today, really showing you what it takes to be a zookeeper. All views throughout the podcast shared are of those speaking alone and in no way reflect the collections they work for. So please come along for the journey, enjoy the ride and thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to Zookeeping 101. My name's James Dennis, I'm your presenter, and today we're talking all things heading a keeper team, and who better to talk to than Gemma Metcalf. Welcome, Gemma, to the show.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me.
No, great to have you on. Now, if you want to introduce you officially to all our lovely listeners, exactly who you are, where you come from, and what title you hold.
Yeah, so I'm Gemma. Originally, I was from Dorset. My whole family live in Dorset, lovely place to grow up, and I am head of Hoofstock at London Zoo.
Absolutely amazing, and what an amazing collection to be part of. Obviously, you have to be very fortunate and very lucky to roll into that sort of position. You usually have to work yourself up, have those amazing stepping stones and journey moments throughout your career. Do you have them?
I've just been incredibly lucky in my career. Very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Look, well, obviously, where did it all begin, though? Where was the first stepping stones behind you, I guess, getting into animals, let alone the career itself?
Well, being from Dorset, my local zoo is Marwell. So I grew up begging my mum to go to Marwell Zoo because even from a little kid, I was obsessed with the Acarpi. Not that I think I knew they were Acarpi, but just the stripy horsey things at Marwell. So I would beg to go to Marwell and then spend all day staring at the Acarpi and the zebra at Marwell Zoo. But I never thought that zookeeping would be like anything achievable. It was like one of those jobs that someone obviously did, but I don't know who it was. And there was no way I was going to do it. So I got into horses. I spent all my teenage years with horses. I've done a lot in the equine industry, traveled the world a bit, done a bit in Spain and Ireland and worked with horses a lot. Did an equine science degree and an equine diploma. So yeah, did lots and lots of horsey things for a long time. And then I was in my final year of my equine degree and I was properly procrastinating about my dissertation. I was so bored and I was thinking, right, I actually need a job. Like, what am I going to do? And after doing 5 years of studying equines, I had come to the conclusion that it was my hobby and it's not what I wanted to do for a career. And I was like, I know what I want to do. I want to work with those Acarpi at Marwell. And whilst procrastinating, I just happened to come across the advert for Chester's internship. And it was actually the final day. So it was like a now or never kind of situation. And I was like, meh, I really don't want to write my dissertation. I'm just going to throw an application form in for Chester's internship. So I sat and I applied and I sent it off. And I genuinely didn't think anything of it. I was like, I've procrastinated. I haven't written my dissertation. I've just sent something off. I genuinely didn't give it a second thought. And then, yeah, I was just so lucky that a couple of weeks later, I got a reply. Will you come to Chester and do an internship? An interview. So I said to my mum, at this point, I already had a job in the equine industry. Quite a well-paid job in the equine industry. And I also had a place to go on to a paid PhD. And I said to my mum, I'm going to Chester for an interview. And she was like, Chester? And I was like, yeah. And this is someone who'd never been further than Winchester. That's as far north as I'd ever been. And my mum was like, you're doing what? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go all the way up to Chester. I've booked a hotel. I'm going to stay overnight. And I've got an interview for an internship. She was like, but you already have a job. And I was like, yeah, I know, but I could be a zookeeper. And I went all the way up to Chester for 2 days. And I spent one day just looking around the zoo. And then I was super lucky to have an interview the second day. And me and Penny at Chester just got on really well and chatted animals for ages and ages and ages. And then, yeah, I was just super lucky to get offered the internship on the rhino section at Chester. And then I was at Chester for a year. And I was super lucky because while I was there, we had 4 rhino calves and lots of other amazing things happened. And then because I just seemed to have the luck, I then applied for a trainee position at London when it came up. So when you're on the internship at Chester, you just kind of apply for every job that comes up. You get further on in the year and you're like, they just tell you, keep applying, apply for everything, apply for everything. And honestly, I'm not joking. London is the least favourite place I would ever want to be. I despise cities. I'm a proper country person. London is literally the bottom of my list of anywhere I would ever want to live. So I don't really know why I applied, but they offered a trainee keepership. It included the DIMS there and it was obviously basically the next step. But I chucked an application form in along with loads of other jobs. Didn't hear anything for 3.5 months. So I just didn't think anything of it. And then randomly one day I was like, oh, you've got an interview. And I was like, oh, so now I got back in the car and came all the way back down to London, had an interview here, and I'd been really swatting up, like seriously swatting up on my zoo stuff. And I'd obviously walked around London Zoo and I'd had filled my brain full of zoo things. And the first question they asked me in my interview at London was, what do you do for horse colics? I'd spent 5 years studying horses. I had a complete blank moment and I sat in my interview like, oh no, what do you do for horse colics? Because I'd just totally forgotten all my equine stuff. Yeah, and then I got the job, surprisingly, after that. So yeah, that was super lucky. And then I've been here ever since, really. So I did a small amount of time with small mammals in the claw, which basically has a nocturnal section in the rainforest, but I hated almost every second of it and spent the entire time begging to be down with the hoofstock. I was like, there's a carpy up there, why are you sticking me down here? So that was awful. I think once they got truly fed up with listening to me moaning, they moved me down to the hoofstock side. And yeah, been here ever since. And I've managed to work with lots of amazing animals and lots of amazing people. Yeah, and just worked up and yeah, now I run the section.
Amazing. I'm very fortunate I've volunteered there myself, and I've seen the work you've been up to. And obviously you've got some amazing animals on that side. Correct me if I'm wrong, pygmy hippo, zebra, giraffe, painted dog, once upon a time at least.
I'm sure every zoo is the same. Everyone loves the restructure. Yeah, we now have all the hoofstock in London Zoo. So we've got, yeah, the pygmy hippos, which are amazing, giraffes, the carpy, zebra, warthogs, red forest duiker, red river hogs, babarusa, camels, alpacas, llamas, goats, cooney cooney pigs, monk jack, Chinese water deer, ostrich. I think that's it.
Amazing. Now, obviously, that's, you know, what a journey from equine beginnings to now effectively running a team on the ground with such a variety of exotic species. Have you got any advice from that journey that you've been on, from those key moments that you've come across? Anything maybe to your younger self or a listener coming in, and any gems you've learned along the way?
I guess the biggest gem is just to work hard. I mean, obviously, I say luck is important, and it is. But I also feel like I've worked my ass off every step of the way, whether that was in the equine industry or when I got to Chester or when I got to London, always constantly pushing forwards and like working as physically hard as possible. And it does get recognised. So yeah, I guess just keep working for it because you will get there.
Totally. And obviously the current role, the modern day zookeeper role, it can be a bit stressful at times. It can be a bit hectic. How have you learned to take on those, I guess, you know, it's a very strong word to use, but those mistakes, those unfortunate moments where it doesn't go so well, and turn them into productivity and true success?
Oh my goodness, so many things that haven't gone so well. Well, I very, very naively decided I'd do my master's degree alongside just getting deputy head of section and doing a master's degree full time and doing a new role running a team was literally the worst idea I've ever had in my life. And I don't think I had time to breathe in that year. So you're going to have situations throughout your whole career where things go wrong. It's absolutely inevitable, but you have to be able to own it. You have to be able to put your hands up, say, do you know what? It was me. I'm so sorry. And I spent a lot of time saying the same thing to my team. Like, it's fine to make a mistake. Making mistakes happens. But we've got to learn from it and we've got to be able to move forward from it. So yes, I've made tons and tons of mistakes throughout my career, but every one of them has taught me something. Every one of them has given me something to go, all right, okay, that's what happened. I definitely won't do that again. Learn from it and move on. And now all those mistakes I get to use to teach the junior members of my team, and I can share my experiences with them and be like, oh, don't do that. I did that once. It was a disaster. It's all useful. And in the end, it's all things that you can share with other people. So yeah. Making mistakes is good.
Couldn't agree more. Now, obviously, that leads perfectly into the building of a team. Obviously, any collection, any zoo across the globe would not be what it is today without those amazing bodies, the amazing people behind them, working on the ground, running the show effectively. So the first question with this is, what do you look for when recruiting within your team? What are you looking for from a team member?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess one of the most important things is having a cohesive team. I want a team that get on really well, that work together really well, that have brilliant teamwork. Shout out to my team. They are awesome. Yeah. So I guess if I'm in an interview, I want someone that's very personable, that's very chatty, very smiley, that, you know, that I know is going to actually be able to come into my team and get on. And I know that sounds, obviously, everything else, experience and knowledge is all really important. But at the end of the day, if you can't get on with the people you work with, that's a big issue. And I can teach people a lot of things. We as a team can teach people, but if they can't communicate and can't get on with us, then that's a big, big issue. So yeah, I'm really looking for people that are happy and smiley and engaging. Yeah, I think that's the most important thing for me.
Totally. And I guess to expand off that then, what can someone do to create an all-rounded approach? You know, there's that constant debate in the industry of what's more valuable. Should I get experience or should I go for a degree? Should I, you know, get a qualification or should I just go straight into the industry along with a whole bundle of other things? What would you suggest on this side of things?
It's so hard. It's so difficult for people trying to get into the industry now. Having just done a round of apprentice interviews, I'd say I had 450 applicants for that apprentice role, which, by the way, is a nightmare to read 450 CVs. So I'd say the most important thing, first of all, is making sure you've got a CV that stands out and a cover letter that stands out. Because if you don't get an interview, you can't sell yourself anyway. And when you're reading through like hundreds of CVs, you need one that pops and stands out and you go, oh, great, I'm going to give them an interview. So especially when you're reading literally hundreds upon hundreds, they need to have a good CV. And I see so many CVs and cover letters that are just awful. And you just literally, sometimes I read the first sentence and I'm like, no. So having a good CV and a good cover letter, super, super important. And then if you've nailed that and you've got an interview, experience versus qualifications. That's tough. I guess it depends what job you're applying for. At London, we now go down the apprenticeship route. So you get your qualifications while you're working and you do it both. Also, obviously, so competitive that you need the experience. At the end of the day, I need someone that can use a broom. So if you've got experience and you know how to sweep and shovel, that's like step one. So experience is really, really, really important. Overly, I just want someone who really, really, really wants to be a zookeeper. Someone that's passionate and motivated.
Well, so you touched on it there. Is there, I mean, you said about the bad stuff. Is there anything you would define as a good CV? Are we talking about, obviously, in year 10, 11, you need to do experience in itself. That's compulsory to a certain degree within the education field. And from that, at college, you might need a certain amount of hours. So obviously, that means that everyone's getting it, right? So how can that person stand out and, I guess, get their foot in the door before they've even got the interview?
Yeah, I guess animal experience is obviously crucial. I don't always look at what animal experience you've got because you're right at the beginning of your career. So it's not necessarily all about animal experience. But if you've gone to uni and you've worked all your evenings in a pub or at McDonald's or at Tesco's or Sainsbury's or something, it proves that you've got that drive and that motivation and you can go out and you can get a job and you can work within a team and you can hold that job down for a period of time. And you've worked really hard to get your qualifications or, you know, whatever it is you want to do. So it's not necessarily just about having that animal experience. I also like to look at things where people have stuck at something for a long time. So a CV that's got, I've done 2 days here, 1 day there, a day here. To me, you can't really get a very good picture from a day or two or even a week in places. So people that have got more long-standing work experience, people that have volunteered, you know, every Monday for years, stands out a bit more, in my personal opinion. But I think everyone's looking for something different and so hard to make yourself unique when there's so many people competing for those jobs.
Very much so. It's a very competitive industry and one everyone wants to be in. So, you know, exactly right. And a very, very good question. That leads us onto the big questions. It's a part of this podcast where we tackle a few of the larger questions. I don't think there's anything too challenging here, but we'll see how we get on, Gemma. Now, number one is people skills. You've talked about it the whole way through so far. It's required at all levels of the industry, but especially in the role that you're in. What would you say, I mean, I guess the question alongside this is, moving up the hierarchical ladder, how would you describe your management style?
Oh, how would I describe my management style? That's a good question. I feel like you should ask some of my team that question. I think I try to always be very honest and very open. So we have a lot of very open discussions. Like I'm always telling them, you know, if I've done something that's upset you, something you don't like, please say, just pipe up and tell me. I guess I'm very early on as well. I've only been the team leader head of Hoofstock for a couple of years. So I'm still learning. And I tell my team all the time, like, I'm learning, you're learning, we're all learning. But yeah, my management style, I'm always leading by example. I guess if I'm asking any of my team to do anything, it's always got to be something that I would be prepared to do as much as it is physically possible with doing everything else. And it is an absolutely enormous role. I will try and be on the ground and engaging with the team and working with them and seeing what they're doing and try my best. I've got quite a big team, but I know from being a keeper how important it is for them to feel valued as an individual and for them to know that their team leader sees what they're doing and sees how hard they're working. So I do try my best. And I literally keep a tally. Right, I've spoken to that person today. Need to speak to that person tomorrow. I must go and see that person do their training on Friday. Just because I know how important that is. I know how much that would be valued. So I spend a lot of my time making sure, you know, I've gone around, everyone trains different species, make sure I've watched the training and seen what they're doing. And I don't want to say therapist, but I spend a lot of my time just talking to them and constantly making sure they're all right and value their opinion and also their careers. What are you doing? What are you trying to achieve? Where do you want to go? Can I help you? Because they all want to do different things and go different places. So I want them to know that I value all of them.
Yeah, I bet. Now, obviously from that, have you learned, and this is delving a little bit deeper, so bear with me, but have you learned about maybe some of your triggers along the way and maybe some calming techniques that basically you've learned to be able to adapt that role further?
I guess for me, I'm very, very, very busy and quite often quite stressed. My techniques for kind of dealing with that, and I know it sounds almost a bit cheesy, but my team are great. And if I'm stressed or worried or having a moment, they want to help me as much as I want to help them. So I just tell them and I'm like, well, this is what's going on. I'm super busy. I've got this. And I tend to just sit down and they'll all support me, which is lovely. Yeah. One of my big things is talk. Don't bottle anything up. You know, don't go home and dwell on things. I try to finish each day having nothing to go home and dwell on. And things like not having my emails on at home. I mean, it doesn't always work, but I try my best not to read my emails at home. And if I'm having a day off, to have a day off. I'm not very good at it, but I'm really working on it. And my team really helps. So I'm lucky.
Amazing. I guess the final thing on this then is we talked about the hierarchy. You've talked about your own management stuff. From your point of view, obviously having progressed up the hierarchical ladder, what advice would you give to those wanting to move up the ladder?
I'd say if you want to move up the ladder, make sure you talk to your manager. So I'm really lucky in that I've had some really good managers that have been really supportive, but I told them that that's what I want to do. I've been like, you know, I want to be able to make a change. And in order to do that, I want to progress. Plus, I really like managing people and enjoy having a team. And I enjoy being able to make those changes and control things. Now, that sounds awful. I'm super controlling. I like having that opportunity to do that. But I've just spoken about it with my managers because they're the people that are already there. They're the people that have got the experience and they're the people that can give you the opportunities to help you get there. And I say the same to my team, like if management is somewhere you want to go, let me know. I will help you. And it's just like they helped me, working super hard at all times. Don't be scared to say to your manager, you know what, actually one day I'd really love your job. I'd love to be able to do what you do. How did you get there? And just talk to them and ask them, because there's so many things that I do every day. I know the individuals that want to go that way and I can help them and give them things to do that allows them to learn and grow.
Yeah, communication's key. You're not wrong. Exactly that. Now, you'd be happy to know you blasted through question one. Okay, check. Big tick on the list. Now, number two is, in your role, having progressed up that hierarchical ladder, as we've discussed, how would you say it compares in terms of the headkeeper role you're in now to that zookeeper role you were formerly in?
Oh, it is completely different. In a good way, though. Management's not for everyone, and I totally get it. But I loved being a zookeeper, absolutely loved being a zookeeper, but I would get very frustrated. There's a lot you're not privy to. There's a lot of things that, although you can try and you can talk and you can communicate, but there's a lot of things you can't change. And I would get quite frustrated about not being able to change and to have a bigger impact on the animals I looked after and the section that I worked in. And it would frustrate me. And that's not because I thought my opinions were right. I just wanted to be privy to the opinions, to know what was going on. Being team leader or head of Hoofstock means that I am able to have those ideas of what's happening. And I now get the choice. I can manage the section. You know, if we need to change substrate, completely redo an exhibit, have more browse, have less browse, training programs, you know, whatever it is, my opinion is heard and listened to. And now I can make all those changes and have those decisions. Yeah, it means that I can have that impact that I've always wanted to have, which I guess maybe it's not the same if you haven't worked in the same collection for 10 years. But when I got team leader, all those things that I've wanted to do for the last 10 years, I was like, great, I can make the changes, I can do things. And that was awesome. And then started, I guess, with me just wanting to do everything for the animals. And all I wanted to do was make a difference to those animals. Whereas now, probably 80% of what I do is to make a difference to my team. All I want to do now is help them. So it's completely gone 360. And now they can make all the difference and they make all the impact. And I just help them. which is great.
I guess to turn it around then, is the role everything you expected from it? If you can, I know it's very hard now that you're living that moment, but going from that keeper looking up, is it what you expected from that role?
Yes and no. There are a lot of frustrations, but there are with every job. There's just different frustrations now. Yes and yeah, I love being a manager and it's not for everybody, but I do like to be super busy, luckily, because I am very busy. I do like to be constantly moving forward, improving and doing better. And as a manager, you can do that. You can be constantly looking to improve for your animals and for your team. I like that. And I can do that now off my own back without the need to talk to anyone else, which is lovely. It is everything and a whole lot more than I thought it was going to be.
That's great. Well, that leads perfectly on to number three. And number three is exactly like you were just saying, is the demand of the industry, let alone the roles within it, are so, so high. And obviously they do require a hell of a lot, you know, whether it be team management, whether it be animal husbandry. And that's not even taking into consideration the different roles of the taxa that includes and the different management, let alone husbandry is required. So I guess within it, how do you juggle it all? How do you give the best husbandry possible, give the best team management possible and so on, and achieve everything that you need to in your role?
I'm very organized. So I think being continually on top of everything, it's impossible, but I do try and be organized. I've got a wonderful deputy team leader who I rely on hugely, and I've got a wonderful team. Although, like you said, there's so many different aspects of it, research and conservation and breeding programs and husbandry and staff and blah, blah, blah. It's just absolutely enormous, and meetings coming out of my ears all the time and hundreds of emails every single day. But being able to delegate and get your team involved is really important. So they help me massively with keeping on top of everything, being super organized. I've got lists upon lists upon lists. I've got lots of whiteboards and things everywhere that try and keep us on track with what's going on. But it all really nails back to that communication, trying to have brilliant communication with everyone. It's so important. Yeah, being organized, having good communication, learning when to switch off, because I wake up at 3 a.m. thinking about how on earth I'm going to get a Red River hog to live on bark chip without eating it. Blah, blah, blah. I wake up at stupid o'clock times, and you have to learn to be able to switch off and turn off. And it's so important to have downtime, otherwise it could just get way, way, way too much. You have to trust your team that they are absolutely fine without you. Switch off, have holidays, have breaks, have time off so that you can unwind, so that when you come back to work you're ready to go and full of energy and can crack on. So yeah, mainly communication, downtime, and trusting your team.
Very well put and very well answered. That one smashed out the park. And I guess the next one leads on to something new. And that's this new Secretary of State guidelines potentially coming in. Obviously, it's still under evaluation, but it is very much on our doorstep. And that next era for change is very much on our doorstep for this industry in the UK. So I guess with it, there's a whole host of things in it, whether it be education, conservation, the way we keep our animals and so on. So with regards to it, it may or may not, or you may not have even thought about it up to this point, but do you see it affecting your role in the future?
I think, yes, it will probably affect everybody's. However, I'm super lucky to work for an organisation that is always pushing ahead. We are constantly pushing forward. And I think that's probably stands us in good stead, you know, constantly trying to work to the most up to date of everything and then push that forwards again. In terms of our husbandry, education, conservation, we're already pushing so hard all the time. It certainly doesn't worry me. Yes, it will affect us and our roles will adapt and the zoo will adapt and what we do will adapt, but that's good. And change is great. Anything that can help us do better and have better welfare for our animals and provide better education and conservation, that's all amazing. So yes, it probably will change my role, but I ask myself frequently, like, what can we do better? So yes, but I think it's a good thing.
Totally. Okay, so we're nearly there, nearly through the big questions. So I've got another question for you though, and that is, being a higher role, obviously overseeing an array of taxonomic groups to a certain degree. As you say, you're the hoofstock side of things, but I did notice you had a random ostrich tucked in there as well. But have you, I mean, I guess we all joke around in the zoo industry that keepers, we're all different. We all match our own animals to a certain degree and the way we are. Does this affect your management style? Do you feel like you have to adapt to your team?
A little bit. I mean, we are hoofstock and we definitely move as a herd. We're very good at moving as a herd. I guess for me, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, it possibly is a negative, but I have only ever worked with hoofstock, apart from that very short amount of time where I did some small mammal stuff and didn't like it so much. I only ever worked with hoofstock, and obviously my background is equine, so literally hoofstock runs in my blood, and I think I'd be like a fish out of water if you asked me to go with any other species. I would just, or taxonomic groups, I wouldn't have a clue, and I wouldn't pretend I had a clue. I guess, does it affect my management style? No, I've got a great team that have a lot of experience. Some of my keepers have been at the zoo for 40 years or have worked in zoos for 40 years, and they have incredible array of hoofstock. Some of them have worked with penguins and birds and all sorts of other things. So I've got ostrich, but I've also got a couple of bird keepers turned hoofstock keepers. So no, I don't think it drastically would affect my management style, but I've also never managed anything else. So I don't really know.
Definitely, definitely. As I say, I'm very fortunate. I came to many years ago the ungulate workshop, and I am fully aware. I saw you training your okapi and your zebras. Very much immersed in life.
It runs in my blood.
Yeah, and I guess before moving on, you'll be happy to know we've pretty much smashed those big questions out of the park. We're through. But before we do move on, I guess for anyone listening in, I'm sure everyone's clocked on already. You've said it many times. It is a hoofstock episode, this one, basically. It is everything hoofstock and hoofstock related, from your equine days through to now looking after all of your amazing hoofstock species. Why are they so special? For anyone listening, for anyone who's, you know, in the industry right now working with a whole range of different taxas, if they haven't already, why should they work with hoofstock?
Because they're the best. They've got amazing personalities. They bring so much opportunity. There's so much to learn. I mean, I guess it's the same with every taxa. I guess there's no specific reason why someone falls in love with one taxa or another, right? It's just where you belong. Maybe I'm just a herd species and it's where I belong. But yeah, they're great. For me, they're great. And I couldn't think of working with anything else.
Cracking. Now, I'll let you off. That's the big questions done. Okay, we've made it through. You can forget about them. We'll move on to the coming towards the final part of this podcast, and that's the quick fire round. So as the listeners will quickly be learning, this can either go two ways. It'll either be treated like the quick fire round, or as they're getting more used to, it will very much erupt into a whole range of conversation and random answers. So we'll see how we get on. The first one, though, is what is your favourite animal?
A carpy.
Or any reason for them?
Oh, they're awesome. They're just so unique and I love them. Closely followed by a zebra, giraffe, rhinos.
Yeah, I expected that answer. There you go. Okay, the number two then. What is your top tip for mental health and well-being?
Oh, learn to switch off. Make sure that when you're not at work, you have switched off, have your downtime, don't read your emails at home. You have to recharge. Like, having that time away is absolutely crucial, and I had to learn that the hard way. Now I know you have to switch off. Make sure that your home life is equally as important as your work life.
Totally great answer. Now the next one then is your best tip for motivating your team.
Oh my goodness, chocolate, cakes, food. every keeper loves food. No, honesty and brilliant communication. Yeah, just talk to your team. Have some good objectives. Make sure that everyone knows what they're working towards. Yeah, and then cake and chocolate.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's definitely the way to every keeper's heart. The next one then, what is the best part of the industry?
Oh my goodness, there are so many best parts. The people, the animals, obviously the animals, but the people. I've met some amazing people in my career that have utterly inspired me and who I will remember forever. So yeah, people.
Great shout. Now, this next question could take you anywhere in the world, and that is, what zoo globally would you like to visit and why?
Oh, that's really hard. What zoo globally? Do you know what? I've been really lucky to go to lots of amazing zoos, but I would quite like to go to San Diego, probably, just because it's one of the big ones that I haven't been to. I was really lucky to go to Australia last year and did some of the Australian zoos, which I loved. Yeah, but I've never been to San Diego, so probably San Diego. However, if I hadn't already been to White Oak, White Oak would have been very high up on my list, but I have already been. But it is awesome, and they have hundreds of okapi.
Amazing. Now, as I'm sure you'll not be surprised, San Diego is coming up in near enough every episode. It is very much a pop culture. It's one of those zoos that every single zookeeper aspires to get to. It's just iconic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very much. So elaborate, though. Where is White Oak? I've not heard of that one.
So White Oak, it's a private collection in Florida. Basically, it's absolutely enormous. So they have something ridiculous like 24 a carpi and 45 rhino, and they have a huge herd of giraffes and elephants and every other hoofstock species that is a hoofy place, but they have lots and lots and lots of hoofstock, and they open up to like private tours, so they do tours of the place, and they do some amazing conservation, have big lodges and do lots of basically fundraising to use for their conservation work. And but the place is incredible in terms of just its vastness. To see so many a carpi in one place is like mind-blowing.
Sounds like true bliss for yourself.
It was. I did 4 days there and it was incredible. I was very lucky.
amazing. Now, some great answers. I'll let you have both of them. Very good answers. Now, the next question then, what would you look to improve within the industry?
Probably work-life balance, because a lot of collections are working really hard, London included, are working very, very, very hard. But it's still an industry that takes so much out of you. And I guess that's because people are just so passionate. But it is so important to think of your mental health. So probably that work-life balance is just so important. So, yeah, if I could change anything, it would be to keep working on that, I guess.
Totally. Okay. Well, this next question is going to sound like I'm repeating myself, but I think this is the big message from this episode. So we're going to cover it anyway. And I think we're going to get a very similar answer. So let's go for it. What is the greatest part of the role that you are in?
That's such a hard question because there's so many different parts. I love working in a collection that lets me have the freedom to make lots of changes and improvements. I love working in such an awesome team with such passionate people. And I love working with some of the most awesome species that there are. So, yeah, animals, people, freedom. What a combo.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this getting towards the end of this podcast now. And number 9 is going to delve a little bit more into your personal side. And that is, in the industry, who is your idol?
That's just like the classic David Attenborough, and everyone's going to say the same thing. Who I have met a couple of times and is wonderful, but I've not got a unique answer.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to, not because you're just in front of me, not because you're trying to big up your ego. As I say, at the Ungulate workshop, I remember you and Jim Mackey training those zebra. And as a fairly new keeper myself, I was inspired in that moment. So I can say that you're definitely inspiring others to like your fellow hoofies.
Yeah, life goal achieved. Those zebras. Yeah, to be fair, those zebras had a big part to play in my early career, training those zebras. Who are still here and who are still wonderful and he'll still do amazing training.
Amazing. No, that's cool. And obviously with those zebra, how many hours do you think you've put into them on a husbandry level, a training level, on a mental level? Do you feel like you've got that work and home balance with those zebra?
No, not at all. Hundreds and hundreds of hours. I've worked with those zebra for 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't actually want to think. It's probably written down because Jim is a stickler for making sure you have a training plan and and record every training session you've ever done. So we could probably, if we really wanted to, work out how much time. But in terms of just time spent with them, not just training, oh my goodness, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. I was very lucky today. I had a very rare day where I got to be a keeper for a day today. And so I've done the carpi and zebra house. Spent a whole day being a keeper with those animals and it's taken me right back. And I was like, oh, how many times have I cleaned this paddock? But it just makes me feel very lucky.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's, I guess that really, before we do come towards the end of this episode, is that really sums up, I guess, changing your role from those, you know, from those early days of, I'm sure, being in the thick of it, you know, being with your zebras, being with your carpies. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, being a bit more maybe management/office/people role, which is not quite what we come into the industry for, but very much an essential part of the industry.
Not what we come to the industry for, but I would not have it any other way. And to be fair, if I've had a morning full of meetings and my head is blown, I can go up to that carpi house and have a scratch within a carpi and I'm like, my world is made. I'm good. Ready to carry on. Or cuddling a goat. A bit of therapy from a goat goes a long way, that does.
Yeah, very much so. Sounds like your team know exactly where to find you if you've gone missing.
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll conclude with one last question for you. It was meant to be a quick fire round. I've very much derailed that. The last one for you is, can you now describe for everyone the whole industry in just 3 words?
The whole industry in 3 words. Passionate, unique, and mind-blowing.
Yeah, very, very well put. And I think a great way to sum up this whole episode and the industry we work in. For myself and the listeners, Gemma, thank you so, so much for coming on and sharing your journey, sharing some stories and talking all thing head keepers.
Yeah, no worries. It was fun. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll get you on again very, very soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take care until then.
Bye.
Bye. And that concludes this week's episode. What an amazing guest and an amazing time we had. Now, if you have enjoyed it, please do subscribe on Instagram, Facebook, or our podcast channels to Zookeeping 101. I can't express how thankful I am personally from a fellow zookeeper to have you along for this quite amazing journey, learning about everything zookeeper. Otherwise, please subscribe. Thank you for listening and see you very, very soon. Bye.